then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, tell me why you hurry so. Hush, you vocal, hush and listen, and his cheeks were all aglow. I bear orders from the captain, get you ready quick and soon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, for the pikes must be together by the rising of the moon. Oh, then tell me, Sean O'Farrell, where the gathering is to be, in the old spot by the river, right well known to you and me. One more bore for signal token, whistle up the marching tune, for your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. By the rising of the moon, by the rising of the moon, with your pike upon your shoulder by the rising of the moon. Out from many a mud wall cabin eyes were watching through the night, many a man big chest was throbbing for the blessed warming light. Farmers passed along the valleys like the man she's lonely crew, and the thousand blades were flashing at the rising of the moon. At the rising of the moon, at the rising of the moon.
Greetings from the Northwest Homeland, comrades. It's January the 9th, 2014. I'm Harold Covington, and this is Radio Free Northwest. Right, off we go for another year of my busting my butt to get you people to respond in some way, anyway besides words, to the Northwest idea on my part. And another year of sitting around waiting for someone else to go first on your part. Let's get started, shall we? I want to start by welcoming yet more new migrants to the Northwest homeland. Now, this includes first and foremost two fine young men from Montana whom I had the pleasure of meeting several weeks ago and who have gone a long way toward lifting my spirits and giving me hope that there is indeed a rising generation of racially conscious young white people out there. We also have new people in Idaho, Spokane, Seattle, and Olympia who are in the process of being intro-packed and brought on board, and judging from what I know of them so far, I'm confident that they'll work out, although developing a full-fledged Northwest nationalist takes a lot of time and reading and reflective thought. I know that some of you probably think I'm making all these alleged new converts and migrants up, or at least exaggerating. That's the thing. No, I'm not. Okay, the tiny trickle of newcomers hasn't increased to a roaring flood, not by any means. It's only more of a stronger trickle, and the number of racially conscious whites coming here is still nowhere anywhere what it should be, since by rights it ought to be in the millions. But people, I'm not making this up, and I'm not gilding the lily when I tell you that the mountain, which has been damn near immovable for 5 years now, is at long last starting to rumble and shift just a tiny wee bit. There are signs in the form of an increasing number of questions, comments, inquiries, and requests for literature and white books from people who are clearly serious, intelligent adults and who appear to have little or no previous movement baggage to bring with them, which is exactly the kind of people that the Northwest Front needs. Guys, it's beginning. Really. Why so many people are choosing to make their move in the dead of winter is a mystery to me, but no jive, it's happening. Okay, now, some more housekeeping comments real quick. Guys, for those of you who missed the news last summer, a young man named Edward Snowden publicly revealed something that we have all known for some time, but which the dictatorship can now no longer credibly deny. This is that the dictator's servants in the various secret police organs have been intercepting and archiving every email and text message sent in the United States and most of the rest of the developed world for almost 13 years now. I happen to know from my own personal experience that the FBI has been intercepting all emails sent to and from every American computer since October of 2001, because I was working for a computer tech support company in Texas back then when the Bureau installed something called Carnivore on the American Internet and crashed just about every ISP's email system for a few days, including the ISPs we serviced, which is how we found out about it. No, the secret police are not reading everybody's emails and texts. They have nowhere near the manpower to do that. They're actually monitoring only a handful of accounts, which almost certainly includes ours, since I am on the official terrorist watch list for my Northwest novels, and also for the famous or infamous Brandenburg lectures, which I podcast on here in the autumn of 2011. Oh, by the way, as a point of interest and something of a point of pride for me, one of the things I've been able to determine is that I'm what you might call a terrorist OG. I actually made it on the watch list almost a year before 9/11, when someone on Hillary Clinton's staff complained to the Secret Service about my novel Slow Coming Dark. Plus, I first got on the presidential list in 1973 when I handcuffed myself to the White House fence as part of a Rudolf Hess protest. Now, I tried getting my Secret Service files under the Freedom of Information Act, and they just ignored me, which they're not supposed to be able to do, but since I can't afford an attorney, they can pretty much do what they like. I was especially interested in the Secret Service file on me since I've been visited by them more often than any other agency down through the years, like when I annoyed Billy Boy after Waco by sending him back my old Army uniform and all two of my medals to him at 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue. A few days later, a couple of them showed up at my job at First Union and, of course, convinced my employers that I was a homicidal maniac. So very shortly after that, they decided to, quote-unquote, move in another direction as far as my position was concerned. The primary was one of these Democrat power bitches in a Hillary suit, a Southerner, I'm ashamed to say, and she said, "Harold, we're worried about what's going on in your mind." Well, I didn't bother to tell her that what was going on in my mind was no business of anyone in the federal government of the United States. She wouldn't have understood what I was talking about. I just told them that I had nothing to say, which pissed them off. I don't know if that Democrat power bimbo ever read Slow Coming Dark, or saw herself in FBI agent Andrea Weinman, or if she ever realizes how damn good I got her. He who laughs last laughs best. And I'm doing it again. I'm rambling, aren't I? Damned Alzheimer's. Anyway, getting back to what I wanted to talk about. How closely they're reading my emails, I don't know. Even a tiny kitchen table operation like the NF generates an immense amount of email and texting and cell phone calling, and they'd have to hire at least a couple of analysts full-time just to listen in properly on the Northwest Front. Maybe they've done that, if only as a way to burn some budget, but I can't help but get the feeling that in the real world we're about 1,327th on their list of priorities, and they haven't bothered to read every email of ours. Archive them, yes, and if they ever really think we're up to something, or if they decide to create some kind of fabricated legal case with a show trial and all, they'll pull all the archived material, and then they'll read it all and start diddling with it, and forging IP addresses and headers, or whatever they decide to do in aid of whatever fabrication they're planning. Anyway, the reason I brought all this up to begin with, in view of the recent revelations of Edward Snowden regarding the NSA and FBI snagging and archiving all emails sent in this country, I'm going to be instituting a new set of security protocols for NF communication, which I suggest that everybody listening to this adopt as much as it's feasible for them to do so. Look, this is the 21st century. We can't go back to the days of the horse and buggy or the file cabinet or the manual typewriter, at least not completely. We have to communicate using email, text, and cell phone. I get that. For routine traffic, I say, okay, our friends in the silk suits don't have the time or the manpower to monitor everybody all the time. And in a way, it's best if we give them something to play with. If the NF were clearly trying to drop completely off the grid and avoid all surveillance, then that would probably rattle them and convince them that we were up to something and increase our surveillance level. When somebody sees a cop and starts running, the cop naturally chases him. Like with a dog, it's instinctive. Now, these new protocols will involve anything that, for whatever perfectly lawful reason, I do not want intercepted and squirreled away until the end of time in the regime's databases in West Virginia and Utah. This more sensitive material will be communicated in handwritten form, by postal letter, and in cursive writing, which now, thanks to Rachel Jontel at the Trayvon Martin trial, has become known as cracker runes. Almost no niggers can read cursive. They never could, even back in the day, because most nigger children are simply too stupid to learn it. No niggers at all below the age of about 50 can read it. No Asians at all can read it, because the immigrants never learned and their Americanized kids were never taught it in public schools. And almost no white people below the age of about 40 can read it. I don't know about Mexicans, but most of them are functionally illiterate in both languages. If you're one of those young white people who cannot read cursive writing, then you damn well need to learn, and shame on you for letting the dictatorship niggerize you like that. I have an idea that cursive cracker runes will, to a large extent, become white people's means of communicating with one another, and concealing what we say from stupid niggers and from white secret policemen until such time as the FBI catches on and starts teaching cursive to its agents. If we shift the important stuff, or at least the confidential stuff, to letters by mail, we can even get around the fluoroscope for a while, until they can track down some older white clerk or somebody who reads cracker runes. Plus, I think it would be a hoot to make those lazy bastards do a good old-fashioned J. Edgar-style mail cover if they remember how. Get in their car, do some driving to post office sorting stations, make them break out the old fluoroscopes and the tea kettles. Now, the reason we need to use handwritten letters and not computers, even in a word processing program, is in case they've got keystroke monitoring software on a particular computer. Let's see if we can make these reptiles work. Cops of any kind hate that. This is just a suggestion for all of you legitimate white nationalists out there to consider. The regime has no right to be seizing and archiving our private correspondence, and we therefore have every right to thwart them in any way we can.
Good afternoon, comrades. Looks like I'm going to get controversial on you today. I debated with myself over talking about this topic because the last thing I want to do is offend anyone with regard to personal beliefs. I've been doing a lot of study lately into our history, the various Indo-European cultures that have existed throughout time, and how our people related among themselves and to the world around them. The more I've studied, the more it's become clear that the way we live our lives today is very different from the way our ancestors lived. And I don't just mean technology and all the modern conveniences we feel so strongly we can't do without. I'm talking about the manner in which they lived their lives and the fact that life was lived in a sacred way all the time, not just on a weekly day of worship, at religious festivals, and other times considered sacred by the specific religion we espouse. But even more than that, and this is where it's going to get pretty controversial, as I continue to study, it occurred to me why it took so long for the various Indo-European cultures to convert to Christianity. I'm not trying to step on anyone's toes here, I promise. I know there are plenty of you listening who proclaim and live Christian identity as the religion of the white man, and I would never try to persuade you any differently. What I'm doing here is pointing out some oddities of the past that don't fit the current versions of history being taught today, or even in the past 50 or 60 years. Something many people don't realize, I didn't until the last couple of weeks, is that contrary to popular belief, the conversion of our people to Christianity didn't happen over a short period of time, but rather over a period of roughly 1,000 years. Beginning with the Goths sometime during the 4th century AD, the mid-300s or thereabouts, and finally ending in 1387 with the Lithuanians. And many of those conversions were by decree or pronouncement rather than by true conversion as Christians define it. My grandma used to say that a man convinced against his will is of the same opinion still. Even though the accoutrements of the religion our people espoused may have technically changed, many of the customs of the Europeans were simply incorporated as is into Christianity, changing only the names to protect the guilty. But why did our people fight so hard for their pagan ways, and why was it so important to those in power that our people convert to Christianity? Other than the obvious reasons of power and money, why could it possibly matter which god, gods, or goddesses people worshipped and served? There's no way to prove the beliefs of any religion by scientific examination or fact-finding, as religion by its nature requires faith in something that is beyond the limits of our human abilities to apprehend. But it would matter a great deal if your eventual goal was the amalgamation of all the various peoples of the Earth into one dumbed-down, semi-literate, mud-colored race. You see, our people are very independent, as we all know, more so than any other race, and this was very evident in the religions that developed as a result of our cultures. Although individualized to an extent, all of the various European pagan religions had many similarities. There were variations on the names of the gods and goddesses, and certain deities were local to certain areas, but they all had some overarching themes, one of them being the honoring of our ancestors and the tracking of our lineages all the way back to the gods and goddesses of our people. It's very hard to get a people to voluntarily change their religion when they wholeheartedly believe that the gods and goddesses they worship are an inherent part of their mental, spiritual, and physical makeup. And you need to get them to change their religion if you're going to use religion to then foster the idiotic belief that all the races are equal and the differences are only skin deep, and therefore it doesn't matter whether you choose someone of the same or a different race to marry and build a life with. The only way you're going to be able to actually begin the process of making people believe all that nonsense is to first get them to change their religion from a polytheistic folk religion based on veneration of many gods and goddesses who are part of time and space and whom the people aspire to imitate, to a monotheistic religion based on one god who is out of space and time, and for all people equally alike. By changing their religion, you break their connection to their past and weaken them as a people. Never mind that little man behind the curtain who claims he's part of the chosen people of this god who is supposed to be for all races. Of course he loves all peoples, but he just loves the people of the little man behind the curtain more. Once you have everyone participating in the same religion, especially those independent, honorary Northmen, then you can start the process of getting them to buy into the story that all the various races on the earth are equal and the differences are only skin deep. Of course, it ends up taking a bit longer than you thought it would because those independent Northmen may have converted to your religion, but in many cases it had to be forced upon them, with the result that you were required to incorporate many of their festivals and customs into this religion. Little did you know that by incorporating their festivals and customs into your religion, you were preserving enough of that culture to eventually allow the white peoples of the world to reconstruct their indigenous way of life and start to reclaim their rightful place in the world. Please don't get me wrong, I am in no way disparaging anyone's religious beliefs, whatever they may be. I think there's room for plenty of variety in our white world, as long as we all respect each other's right to believe as we do, without feeling the need to try to convert anyone else to our manner of belief. Maybe it's time we took a deeper look at exactly what has been unintentionally preserved for us by our captors, and start working toward reclaiming our white racial heritage. Hail victory, comrades!
Now, on the subject of music, I'm getting a lot of guys and gals who are sending me MP3s of their favorite music wanting me to play it on the show, and some of it I like, but here's the thing. A lot of this donated music isn't really racial and can't establish even a tenuous connection to the Northwest or to anything racial or political at all. Look, guys, I don't want to seem rude or brusque, but you need to remember that Radio Free Northwest is a white racial nationalist podcast, and everything on here needs to have at least some nebulous connection with the central topics of race, revolution, Northwest independence, or the 14 words. Now, that being said, here's a song someone sent in that at first I thought was a little bit Enya-ish, but if you listen to the lyrics, I suppose it could be a Northwest migration song of a kind of watery lilac variety. This is someone who calls herself Leia, and the song is We Will Go Home, a.k.a. the Song of Exile.
Land of barren, land of eagle, land that gave us birth and blessing, land that
Right, that song was okay, but before we go on, in view of what I was saying before I played it, in order to illustrate my point, I'm going to play for you one of the stranger things that one of you sent me. Don't worry, I won't count this as an official music break, because it isn't. I don't know what it is. It's entitled Planet of the Apes in 2 Minutes, and it's just odd.
What is this? stinking paws off me, you damn dirty ape! Damn you, you hairy scum! Shut up, you freak! Julius, you... I said shut up! Wait, let me... In you bloody baboon! Stop it! Damn you! Sorry, fool! Remember that? Because you're afraid of me! What are you afraid of, Doctor? Oh, my God. You maniacs! You blew it up! It's a madhouse! A madhouse!
And that completes my final report until we reach touchdown.
Moving right along here, here's Lord Lucan.
This message is about the Queen. In her Christmas message, she talked about reflection. She was, of course, reflecting on her 60 years of reign. Well, let us face it, guys. As far as defending the Christian faith, she deserves a zero. She is the head of the Church of England, the defender of the faith. Huh? She calls Christianity the English tradition. Well, the white race supports Christianity because Christianity is a superior religion when you compare it to others, such as Islam, Judaism, Hinduism, etc. Christianity is a philosophy. Buddhism is also a philosophy. Christianity has led to Western civilization. Back in 1050, we saw the end of the Vikings because Denmark had become a Christian nation. On his deathbed, Muhammad requested that because both Christians and Jews had rejected his ordination as a prophet, that his followers exterminate both Christians and Jews. As evolutionists who believe in survival of the fittest, we must see to it that Islam is exterminated instead. Islam seeks to exterminate all other religious faiths and political ideology. Muhammad teaches jihad or holy war to achieve Islam's global supremacy. The Queen, as the so-called defender of the faith, has allowed England to become a cesspit as a result of allowing a religion that is barbarian to the extreme. Religious freedom has come to the world as a result of Oliver Cromwell winning the English Civil War and England, together with America, becoming a world power. Supporting or believing in backward religions is anti-evolution, and National Socialism, according to Mein Kampf, means evolution. 100,000 Christians were murdered by Islam in 2012. There is a continuous war taking place on the edge of all Muslim nations. Pakistan and any other Muslim nation cannot be considered part of the Commonwealth. Muhammad preaches holy war, and he teaches that war is deception. Deception? Come on, guys. If a so-called prophet of God is preaching deception, then who is he working for? You cannot sign a peace treaty with a philosophy that practices deception. It is not worth the paper it is printed on. The idea that one does not have to practice honesty towards people that you do not consider to be your neighbor comes from the Talmud. Not only do we have Judaism as the synagogue of Satan, but we also have Islam. If we look at Africa, are the blacks going to succumb to Islam and revert back to the Middle Ages? Or will they struggle to become more evolved and convert to Christianity? If the blacks defeat Islam in Africa, it will save us whites from having to exterminate all of Africa to make the world safe for civilization. In her 60 years of reign, the Queen has never refused to give the royal assent to any bill placed before her. Therefore, she deserves the title, the Rubber Stamp Queen. She has signed into law the communist agenda to destroy England. I personally sent her a book entitled The Political Incorrect Guide to Islam and a copy of The Code of a Jew to the palace. So far, she has ignored obtaining the knowledge of evil religions and doing anything about them, and therefore has to be considered a traitor to England. Now a word about Tommy Robinson. Nobody, upon coming to the knowledge of Islam as an evil religion, can change their mind unless they have been bribed. we have to conclude that he has taken a cheap bribe to abandon the English Defence League. Now let me deal with this nonsense of not liking skinheads. A political party that needs image is a bourgeois political party. A proletariat or working class political party, such as National Socialism, does not. If the working class engage in violence to achieve their political objectives, it is because violence is, in the end, the only option. First, before we execute all the traitors, we have to raise an army. To raise an army for the revolution, we have to have the freedom of speech. It is unfortunate that in order to make evolutionary progress, the primitive means such as violence have to be used to defeat primitiveness. Are the natives friendly? Yes, Prince Philip, they are very friendly. They have put the Christians on the menu, and they say that they taste very good.
Good evening, comrades. Tonight I'm going to speak of a rather odd book called Under the Nile by Andy Nowicki. Now, this is a story about a young man who grows up with the aspiration of becoming a priest. Even as a child, he is reprimanded in the sense that he seems to retreat into the Bible and later into the cloth when he is dissatisfied with the world around him. And when he is in seminary school, he takes a psychological test, which seems to indicate that he is really right for the priesthood. So at this point, he is dismissed from seminary school. He's told that perhaps he could come back later, but this event causes him to be very depressed because he knows that he'll never be able to return to seminary school, that realistically what they're saying about him is true. And so he just goes off. Somehow he gets an apartment and he starts to drink very heavily because he really has no use for the world anymore. However, instead of renouncing completely, he continues to write a blog and he sees a therapist. So at some level, he wants to get better and become a priest, but he knows that he really can't. Now, as he goes more and more heavily into alcoholism, at one point he is hospitalized. During that hospitalization, he is visited by a mysterious government agent who leaves a calling card. Now, he says that as he's in the hospital and recovering, he says, you know, I really should not pursue that. It's probably not a good thing. And I should renounce completely and I should stop caring about the world entirely. But there's still this part of him that's curious about this, and so he calls the number on the card, and instantly someone picks up. Now, he goes to dinner with this individual, and this mysterious salesman tells him about this new drug called Nile that he's going to take, he could take twice a day if he agrees to be part of this experiment. What Nile does is it releases someone's inhibitions. And the reason the government wants to test this drug is because the government is very concerned about radical Islamists and how difficult it is to fight these radicals when these radicals want to die. Typically, Americans, for example, really don't want to die. And the protagonist in the story, he understands this. He understands how if someone wants to die, because after all, he's pretty close to wanting to die himself, that it's hard to beat someone in a war if that person really wants to die. So he agrees to be part of this experiment. And at first, he starts taking these pills twice a day. And he lays around his apartment. Of course, everything's paid for, his apartment, his groceries, and all of that, and any medical costs that he might have. So he likes this. He can get a free ride from this mysterious drug company or agency. But he starts writing some rather strange poems. He feels that he can do that now because he's under the influence of this drug. A little bit later, he starts getting involved in a relationship with two women that he really doesn't have any interest in, but he kind of plays with them for a while. But then finally, at the end of all of this, he decides that he wants to know what's in the drug. And so he calls a meeting with his handler, and he overdoses on this strange drug. Handler will not tell him what's in the drug. Actually, the handler says there's nothing in the drug. Then he decides that he's going to go to New York and he's going to commit suicide in a very spectacular way, very much like what Joe Stax did. And so at the end of the book, you're kind of left hanging. It tells you the moments leading up to the suicide. You don't actually read about the suicide itself, it's just the moments leading up to it. And then, of course, because the protagonist dies, you're kind of dropped. Now, the prologue of the book, there's a quote from King Lear that essentially says that nothing comes from nothing. So maybe this book is trying to talk about what happens when white men particularly go off the rails and do something crazy. And perhaps the author is writing a kind of a cautionary tale against that and saying that that is pointless. I would have to say, of course, that this is a very depressing book. I had seen this book for some time, and I wasn't sure if it really tied to this show particularly, but I decided that, well, it's one thing that I've never reviewed. You know, I've reviewed so many books that sometimes I have to say to myself, well, what's going to come next? So I found this book, which is very existential, a rather Faustian book. I decided, well, why not review it? And although it leaves me hanging in a way, I thought, well, I'll discuss it on the show. And perhaps that feeling of nothingness is what the author intended. So that may not be a fault of the book. It may simply be the artistic point inherent in it. So I hope that you enjoyed this review. It's somewhat of an interesting book, I suppose, and perhaps it would have even more meaning if one were to read Dostoevsky's The Idiot, because there's a reference in this book to that novel, so maybe that would even illuminate this book. So I hope you enjoyed my review. Thank you for listening.
Last week, during our all-music episode of Radio Free Northwest, I was talking about the medieval minstrels and troubadours who literally had to sing for their supper in taverns and feasting halls and on street corners, whatever. In addition to the ballads and dirty limericks and whatnot that they actually had to sing, they also had several instruments that they would play. The oldest stringed instrument that we know about is the lyre, and they were fairly popular up until about 1600 or so. Then there was the lute, which is kind of an ancestor of the mandolin, but probably the oldest stringed instrument after the lyre itself was the harp. And of course, the Celtic peoples of Ireland and Wales hung on to the harp a lot longer than other nations did, and accordingly, their harpers were very famous, very well known. A lot of their harp music was written down, and if you really want to know what music was like back in the olden times, wasn't like it is today, you didn't have a band, usually you had one or two guys plucking on a harp or playing a recorder or whatnot, but more often than not, it would be a single harper. This is a Welsh harp piece called Inish Mona, which means the Isle of Mona, i.e. the Isle of Anglesey in northern Wales, and the harpist is Marion Lasoliac. Thank you.
Greetings from Seattle, comrades. Andy Donner here. During my time in the white nationalist movement, I've seen far too many people concerned with libertarian system politics or varying forms of class warfare. White nationalism in general, and the Northwest Front in particular, don't care for either of these things. I've decided to spend a little time on these subjects today. The libertarian and system politics fallacies bother me more than anything else in the movement. The system politics fallacy is something we've covered before, so I won't spend time on it longer than it will take me to point out that anyone listening to Radio Free Northwest knows, on some level, that we are not going to vote our way out of our racial problems. Recently, I've come to the conclusion that the libertarian fallacy is more or less the same thing. The idea of making the government get out of our lives and leave us alone certainly seems desirable, and I have a hard time faulting people who want to be left alone. But that doesn't do anything about our racial situation. Our real problems, despite the amount of government interference we face minute by minute, are entirely racial and not immediately related to what goes on in Washington, D.C. or in our state capitals. Sure, things wouldn't be as bad if we weren't being Jewed constantly, but that doesn't exactly get us to the Northwest American Republic. Remember this fact if you get nothing else out of my talk today. Our race has always had the most difficulty when non-whites are able to walk among us with impunity. Yes, Jews are evil. Yes, their influence, their laws, and their economic crimes are nothing but destructive to us and our natural, moral way of life. We've dealt with them in the past and we'll deal with them again. We've survived them before and we'll survive them again. What we've never been able to handle is what the other non-white races do to us on a physical and genetic level. Some of the best white racial governments in history, may I remind you, were entirely authoritarian and centralized their power. They weren't libertarian in the slightest and would have been offended at the suggestion they slacken their duty to preserve our race. Don't think I don't understand. The system wrongs you every hour on the hour and you want it out of your life. I'm in the same boat as you, and I would be immensely happier if the twisted, domineering, invasive beast system weren't around to inhibit me from taking care of myself. I know you feel the same way. But this raises a very important subject. You'll notice that I mentioned my situation isn't fundamentally different from yours. And it isn't. Realizing this is part of what motivated me to undertake the Northwest Migration for the purpose of assisting the party to bring about the Northwest American Republic. You're not going to avoid your true racial problems even if your preferred libertarian champions are given the run of the country. And I'm not going to avoid my true racial problems by pretending like my upper-middle-class background means I can avoid what happens to other white people. Like them or not, those morons who make fools out of themselves attending racist events in public were right, and I went through quite a bit to learn that. I can't avoid my racial fate by falling back on whatever economic achievement I might or might not attain, and none of us can avoid that same fate by merely opposing Zog's intrusiveness. These are both Judaic strategies to tempt us all to sidestep dealing with actual problems. Class warfare, however, is the far more effective of the two. Always remember that materialism and the lust for wealth are Judaic phenomena. Instigating class warfare is one of the most common ways the Jew disguises itself by hiding behind all sides of the conflict. For this reason, any attempt at promoting actual white nationalism, which is defined by living your life in accordance with the 14 words, must suppress class warfare at any cost. The premise by which class warfare is initiated is by giving the various segments of society the impression that the other classes are somehow wronging them, taking resources they would otherwise retain, or otherwise making their lives difficult. Whether this is through outright communism or the subtle deception of capitalism, white men with more are made to hate white men with less and vice versa. This is totally at odds with proper white nationalism because as racists, we understand that people are what they are regardless of environment, wealth, or other temporary factors. Differences between groups are at the heart of understanding biological reality. Each of us understands that a nigger is a nigger, a chink is a chink, a Jew is a Jew, and an Aryan is an Aryan. They don't belong around each other, and there's nothing anyone can do to change their race, various jokes notwithstanding. Those of you who have been keeping up with the reading list recommended by the Northwest Front will be familiar with a book titled The Revolt Against Civilization, The Menace of the Underman by Lothrop Stoddard. Stoddard goes to great lengths to illustrate how important one's genetics are towards their capabilities, inclinations, and decisions. Class is largely a static matter, and that ought to be obvious to every white nationalist. But here's where things get hairy. Before class warfare can be instigated by the Jew, the concept of class must first be confused with wealth. Classes have a tendency to manifest themselves along financial lines, but that's not at all a defining aspect of Aryan social order. Throughout history, there have been innumerable instances of upper-class families, as well as many dynasties, being brought to ruin financially. That doesn't knock them out of the upper class, and it certainly doesn't mean their societal replacements were of the same quality. Lothrop Stoddard, in The Revolt Against Civilization, brings up the opposite case where high-quality military officers were found in mountain country USA. They, due to their lineage, were upper-class people regardless of their poor conditions. A modern display of the subtle difference between class and wealth is that of the recent Duck Dynasty faggot flub in the media. I don't watch the show, and I hope you all can find something better to do with your time as well. Nevertheless, it's a proper match to what I want to illustrate today. That family is absolutely loaded, but they're quite low class. The remarks their patriarch made about perverts and the things they occupy themselves with are quite correct, but don't really belong in polite society. Don't get me wrong. I'm not looking to stick up for deviants. Quite the opposite. Don't miss my point. A superior individual would have some awareness that they needed to choose their words carefully simply for the sake of being polite. An upper-class, high-quality individual would have known how to act in that interview situation more so than a backwater hick would have. This, more than anything else, ought to put the lie to Judaic class warfare. Not everyone with money is in the upper class, and not everyone in the upper class has money. In fact, it's well understood that the ruling elite in the annals of European history were frequently in debt to those of lower societal ranks when they ran into trouble with money. I suspect the true underlying cause of class warfare is nothing more complicated than the grass is always greener. When an individual, a family, or segment of society is under stress from an outside factor, it's very easy for them to blame the first available target. And in the case of racial strife, the nearest target is another member of your race, but not necessarily your social strata. I always try to leave you guys with something practical to take away from my Radio Free Northwest appearances. Today, that would be to stop blaming people with more than you for causing your problems, because they're probably not. Moreover, you need to accept that your situation in life can't be due solely to finances or lack thereof. Trying to make various classes equal is like trying to make various races equal. It's wrong and unnatural. Classes, like races, are part of reality. Hail victory, comrades.
Okay, I just replayed what I've done so far on this show, and I see that, as often occurs, I didn't quite make myself completely clear on one subject, specifically the idea that the white nationalist movement as a whole, and the NF in particular, needs to return as much as we can to paper and postal correspondence, either handwritten or typed on a typewriter, in order to avoid keystroke recording software, so I'm going to briefly revisit that topic. As often happens when I ad-lib, I left out the main point that I was trying to make, the main reason that I was broaching the subject at all. Now, I know some of you, when you heard that, must have wondered why the hell I was telegraphing my intentions to the regime. Guys, it wasn't about me, it was about you, and I should have made that clear. Okay, let me lay this right on the line. Now, you guys who are in email contact with me need to be careful what you say to me, especially when you are in the first flush of your enthusiasm for the Northwest Republic, and you've just read the novels, and you're all inspired, and you want to, yeah, yeah, let's get it on, let's do it, Harold, yeah, yeah, and there's nothing wrong with that, by the way. I get that a lot. But you do kind of need to be aware that, you know, Big Brother's watching. Now, we really, really are starting to get a lot of new people in, and some of you guys are getting all wildly enthusiastic and pouring out your souls to me in your joy at finding that you are not alone in your racial views, that you're not the only person in the world who sees what you see, that there are others, and you are saying things that our unpleasant eavesdroppers over the back fence don't need to hear. And you're revealing things about yourselves that the dictatorship doesn't need to know in these emails some of you send me. Now, all the emails in this country, I repeat, are recorded and archived, as we know for sure from Edward Snowden now, although I knew it long before. And there are very few email accounts in this country which are more likely to be at least periodically read and reviewed than email to my address. Now, I'm not going to get into the big encryption debate right now as to what encryption the regime can't break and whether or not any such encryption exists at all, really, or whether it's all just internet hype. Now, my personal belief is that the regime can break anything, but I'm not going to argue the point. That's not what I'm talking about here. Suffice it to say that I do not encrypt my primary public email account for two reasons. Number one, I am too old and lazy, and my brain is getting a bit too foggy to spend my time constantly trying to learn new computer software, either from help pages or from people trying to coach me from hundreds and thousands of miles away. I was barely able to learn WavePad like that back when Colonel House was alive. And becoming a supercomputer geek isn't in my job description. I'm supposed to have supercomputer geeks at my command. Now, right now, I'm an office boy who actually needs to cut down the time he spends behind this keyboard. Now, the second reason I don't encrypt is because it's waving a red flag in front of a bull. Now, right now, no one in any way connected with the Northwest Front is breaking any laws, and I don't want to give the secret police any excuse to claim that we're criminals or that we're up to something. I say again, when a cop sees somebody running and trying to evade him, he's going to start chasing. Now, this does not mean that the rest of you cannot or should not use encryption if you so choose in your communications with each other, but why not just avoid the whole issue by going down to your local Goodwill or pawn shop and see if you can dig up an old typewriter? Better yet, an old manual typewriter, or you can get a new small electric one from Staples or Office Depot. They do still sell them, you know. I'd be glad to see us all refurbishing an ancient skill. Take some time and thought composing letters and messages rather than just blurting it all out on email or Twitter. This will have the advantage of drying up some of these long, long emails I'm getting from people pouring out their souls to me and revealing all kinds of things about themselves that are now in the hands of the FBI due to Carnivore 7.0 or whatever the hell they're using now. No kidding, guys. I've gotten some emails lately that were kind of TMI. You guys need to wrap your minds around something. What we are doing is dangerous. This country is ruled by men and women with incredible wealth and power who can only be described as evil. And these evil men and women pay other very bad people to do terrible harm and wrong to anyone who challenges their wealth and power. Our first line of defense against them, since we refuse to use the defense that the Founding Fathers left us, is simple common sense. Common sense should tell us to walk carefully in a cow pasture or we're going to step in something. Okay, quick email. Dear Harold, now that you've completed the Northwest novels, do you plan to write any more fiction? And if so, on what topic? Signed, Brody in Ireland. Dear Brody, no, I'm afraid not. The upcoming 5th edition white book is probably the last major writing project I'll ever do. Unless I get locked up in a cell somewhere with a lot of time on my hands, kind of like Bill White. The reason is simple. Things have reached the point where somebody has got to step forward and at least make some attempt to get something organized, which means dealing with, oh, God, how can I put this without going off into a tirade? It means that I am going to have to cease being a writer, and I'm going to have to launch my final career as a junior high school principal with several thousand gray-haired male adolescents to ride herd on, and a few naughty girls as well getting up to shenanigans in the boys' locker room. The trick to being the principal of Movement Junior High is to see if I can flunk out and expel most of the middle-aged adolescents. Keep the ones who appear actually to want to learn something and succeed in life, build a proper faculty of actual adults, and then somehow bring in a whole new student body from the community itself, kids who haven't been in the same junior high school all their lives and who have not picked up all these terrible bad habits. Okay, I won't stretch that metaphor anymore. Why me? Because I'm about the only one left standing who's qualified, and because the Northwest Imperative is the only actual plan that anybody's got. That's not that I'm unique. I'm not. There are other men who could do it. Quite a few others, in fact. But for whatever reason, either through fear or disgust at the past or simple exhaustion after years of beating their heads bloody against the wall of defective white character, they will not step forward. So looks like I've drawn the short straw. Anyway, the short answer, Brody, is no. If you want more racial stuff, you guys can try some of my other novels like Fire and Rain and Slow Coming Dark, although those are pre-Northwest. Now, if you do that, you need to read Fire and Rain first. It's the first Matt and Heather novel, and you need to get the backstory before you read Slow Coming Dark, which is the book that first got me on the terrorist watch list back before 2001, and which makes me a terrorist OG. Now, this email is from Trevor in Virginia. Dear HAC, did you know that the Jews always had the same trouble with Israel that you are having with the Northwest, not being able to persuade most Jews to actually immigrate there? Dear Trevor, yes, I know. I read Zionist works and Israeli websites, and a lot of Israelis still aren't happy with all these big rich Jews who are lounging around by their swimming pools or banging their shiksas or going to huge luxurious reform temples in New York and Los Angeles and Miami and London and Buenos Aires and Johannesburg, where the Jews have made a nice comfortable arrangement with the savages from the ANC. Now remember, a lot of so-called white South Africans you see quoted in the media are in fact Jews. Yes, Trevor, I can see that even once we receive the Northwest Republic, there are going to be millions of white people who are too bird-brained, stupid, to move there. One of the many bridges we will have to cross when we come to it. Okay, I think we need to liven up this episode. This is Tony Ellis. Okay, rather than close this episode out with a tirade, I'm going to talk about that guy with the beard who hunts ducks, and whose show I have never seen, and which I probably wouldn't watch even if I had cable TV, since I have no interest at all in shooting ducks or any other kind of bird. There's a lot of living organisms on this planet who urgently need to be shot. Birds are not among them, except maybe pigeons. I know, they're basically rats with wings. I think I've eaten duck maybe 3 times in my life. I seem to recall it has an odd gamey taste, very different from chicken, but there was never much meat on the carcass, and I'm rambling again. Anyway, the reason I'm talking about Phil Robertson is that I'm apparently expected to state and restate the obvious every time something racial hits the headlines, and although Phil Robertson may be kind of old news now, remember last week was the All Music Show, so actually it's been 2 weeks now, which is why I'm behind on the news. Now, the Robertson incident is significant because for the first time I can remember the Democrats, the ruling party, and their attack dog media have failed to crush someone with celebrity who had what the media calls a Michael Kinsey moment, i.e. he or she accidentally blurted out the truth in front of a microphone or a camera. Basically, A&E as a network has gone way down since I last watched them about 20 years ago. A&E is apparently on the ropes, and they've decided that in this one case, since Duck Dynasty is their biggest earning show, political correctness isn't worth committing economic suicide over. Oh, and during the Phil Robertson flap, I actually caught the Democrat blogs using the term economic discipline. Apparently, that's what it's called now. the power structure economically disciplines those who step out of line. Well, in this one case, it didn't work. The old profit motive won out, aided by a good kick in the ass to A&E from millions of white Americans who apparently do like bearded people in Louisiana who shoot ducks. By the way, that's another thing I wanted to bring up with you guys as my first proposal as principal of Movement Junior High. I think we need a better term for the enemy propaganda-wise, one that will hit home to what Rush Limbaugh calls the low-information voters, which is a polite way of saying white dumbasses who are stupid enough to believe what they see on TV. I've been using terms like liberals and lefty libs, and other people just say the left, and they talk about the media and the Jews and the world conspiracy and Zog and blah, blah, blah. But I think we need to focus white people's anger on something that they understand, something that's in everyday usage, something they don't have to have explained to them because they know what a Democrat is. Something that has a visible face, in this case the baby shit brown face of Barack Obama and the withered sea hag face of Hillary Clinton. Since all of these terms like liberals and left lib and left and progressive and whatnot basically mean the same thing, i.e. the present power structure, which is inimical to human life on this planet, I don't see why we don't just start using the term Democrats. Yes, I know that makes us sound like we're Republicans, and yes, I know the Republicans are just as bad. My God, do you think I've forgotten 8 years of Jug Ears Bush? Now, the actual name of the Thought Crime blog, remember, is downwithjugears.blogspot.com. I'll talk to you guys more about that next week. Also, for next week, I need to get some feedback from you comrades out there on a topic that we were talking about on the Northwest Revolution list before Christmas. Before everybody wandered away to swill eggnog and go ho-ho-ho. I mean, legal literature distribution in urban areas covered by closed-circuit spy cameras in places like downtown Seattle, downtown Portland, other urban areas where the dictatorship has 1984-style spy cameras on every corner. How does the party distribute literature in general without the secret police identifying Northwest Front operatives, cataloging their identities, and using the law to harass them and do an end run around the First Amendment? Now, we need to revive that particular discussion. But for now, our time is up, and so that's it for this week's edition of Radio Free Northwest. This program is brought to you by the Northwest Front, Post Office Box 4856, Seattle, Washington, 98194. Or you can go to the party's website at www.northwestfront.org. This is Harold Covington, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Sasha Anaban. Freedom.